Once in a generation is born a talent.
A talent.
So gleaming and bright.
So bright.
That it shines in even the stinkiest turds.
Like Congo and the Core.
Tonight, we talk about just such a man.
Dun dun.
Delroy Lindo.
Lindo Vision. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Terranauts and multiverse agents to another far out and yet introspective episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on Film School Rejects. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film podcast that is so good, it just has to be fattening. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and joining me as always is my friend and co-host, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
I want to remind you guys that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/... You guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. And yes, we're about to wrap up the month of February, which means we are wrapping up our month-long exploration of our favorite black character actors. And, you know, I gotta say, from the guesses I saw people making on Twitter as to who the final honoree would be, it became abundantly clear that we need to do this again next February.
Oh, well, I mean, talking about great black character actors alone, you know, there's such a sea of great talent.
Yeah.
You know, you want to talk about just character actors, which is something we regularly do. And really what we should be doing is taking that list and spread that out over the rest of the year. We did this because there were two particular actors that you and I had talked about several times wanting to do episodes on, Joe Morton and Yaphet Kotto. Mm-hmm. And then it was like, hey, this gives us a perfect excuse to do a month of it. But from here on out, I think we should just keep, you know, trucking along and doing it.
Totally. So tune in next February when we will probably do this again. And by probably, I mean definitely.
Maybe.
Yeah.
If we haven't gone through this year and done a number of these people, I didn't see the list because people didn't send me the names. So I'm really curious. What were some of the popular?
Keith David was a popular one.
Of course.
Pam Grier.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. I know I still want to do one on Fred the Hammer Williamson.
Well, we have to do an episode on Fred the Hammer Williamson, hands down.
Yeah.
Like we've already talked about half of his movies in this show to begin with.
So it'll be like a clip show.
It'll be a clip show.
Junk Food Cinema clip show. But today we are in fact talking about Mr. Delroy Lindo.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Lindo's interesting because Delroy Lindo was born in England to Jamaican parents who moved him to Ontario before finally settling in America, where he studied and graduated from the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco. He had his first official movie role in More American Graffiti in 1979.
And that's about as much as we should probably ever say about More American Graffiti.
True story. But the interesting thing about Delroy Lindo is that he, you know, he broke into the business and worked for a while and then kind of had that problem where he just wasn't getting the work that he wanted. And
you mean that Hollywood doesn't hire black actors to play anything but stereotypes during a certain period in history?
Yes, I guess that is what I am saying without saying it, but now it's been said. So he fires his agent and ends up getting his real big break in 1992 in Malcolm X, playing a character named West Indian Archie. And from there, working with Spike Lee and getting hooked up with all of these filmmakers who are really taken by him and have seen him on stage. And he kind of has that that second push, you know, later in life that we've seen from a number of actors we've talked about where it took them a while to really get going. And Delroy Lindo is certainly one of those. And also fascinating is that the movies that we kind of unanimously decided on to talk about, because we do like to talk about schlocky films, and we also like to talk about underrated films.
We like to talk about junk food. And junk Malcolm food. X is not junk food.
Malcolm X, not so much with the junk food.
They're just kind of like one of those greatest film ever made kind of films. Not really junky.
More in the greatest film ever category than in the junk food category. So, but fascinating is that the movies that we decided to talk about, I realized as we were putting the notes together that all take place within a 2-year window.
Yeah.
Like, all these movies we're going to talk about have been released, you know, from 2000 to 2003.
He became that genre actor you got. When you needed a role that needed to have huevos added to it, mm-hmm. but didn't necessarily have tons of screen time, he was the guy you went to because every second you put Delroy Lindo on the screen, he owns it. And you instantly connect with that character. He plays antagonists in these movies, and you still fucking like him as an antagonist. Like, he just has this natural charisma and this alpha maleness that he never, ever has to prove. He just walks up to someone and deepens his voice, and it's like, I'm not fucking with this guy.
Yeah, and what I always enjoy about Delroy Lindo's characters is that, you know, Lindo has the commanding presence of somebody like Samuel L. Jackson, but with a much softer touch. Like, you rarely see a Delroy Lindo character just come in and start raising his voice.
No, he doesn't have to. So great about it. No, that's what I love about even his most understated roles. He still, you know, he commands the room. There's just something naturally charismatic about him that he does not. Like, the thing is, with Samuel L. Jackson, he's a charismatic guy, but when you hear him talking as Sam Jackson, he's a very down-to-earth guy. Mm-hmm. And he usually has to kind of crank it up to 11 to really, like, blow up. But those cranking it to 11 moments are epic.
Totally.
You know, when you bring Sam Jackson in and he goes the full Sam Jackson, which you're never supposed to go, but he can.
He does, yeah.
He just kind of blows everything out of the water. And Delroy Lindo never, ever has to do that.
Definitely. And the first movie we're going to talk about in the sort of our some of our favorite Delroy Lindo characters is Gone in 60 Seconds from 2000. Now, I'm excited to talk about this movie because I like the remake, but I also really like the original. If you haven't seen the original from 1974, it is a complete, I mean, it is the epitome of independent filmmaking because they didn't use any real actors. They basically was just the director's friends and one actual mayor of the city where they were shooting playing the mayor of that city. There's a charming recklessness to it, like that sort of, we definitely did not acquire permits for this really long, dangerous car chase kind of recklessness.
Yeah.
And, you know, the remake is very much a sleek Bruckheimer action vehicle.
It's what I like to call Fast and Furious Year Zero. Like, rewatching this film, you realize how much the Fast and Furious series has mined every single scene in Gone in 60 Seconds and spread it out over 6 movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes all the best elements eventually. Like, the 5th Fast and the Furious until they really had taken the 3rd act of Gone in 60 Seconds and really done something with it. But no, Delroy Lindo in this, of course, is the antagonist.
Right.
He's the cop who's on the trail of our heroes/criminals.
Right, exactly. Because the anti-heroes, obviously, are Nicolas Cage at, like, just that perfect middle level between completely bug-nuts Cage and actual prestige Cage. Like, he's right in the middle because he has these little moments. He doesn't go full, you know, Vampire's Kiss Cage in this movie.
There's a moment, like, when he plays Lowrider, and he does a little thing with his fingers, and you're just waiting for him, and then he pulls it back and goes, okay, let's go.
I still think the craziest he gets in this movie is when he's running away from Master P, who is a character in this movie for some reason, and he runs into that diner where the cops are eating, and he's like,
long as I'm in here, you're just gonna sit out there, aren't you?
Oh, Nicolas Cage, please never say I. Please don't do that ever again.
Yeah, no, he's at that perfect age where you can cast young, hot Angelina Jolie as his romantic foil, and it not be, like, creepy and gross.
Although, like, it seems like they dirtied her up a little bit to kind of,
they,
like,
really did,
to make them a better match. Maybe they thought audiences would find her out of his league if she didn't look like, I don't know, the bass guitar player for some neo-rock group of the early millennial rock group of the 2000s.
Yeah, she's a little extreme in it. And there's that moment where they have that really supposed to be steamy romance scene sitting in the front seat of the car where they start talking about stealing cars and having sex. And for a minute there, you're like, oh, this is very effective. And then you're like, it's Nicolas Cage and Angelina Jolie. Ew. No,
I'm not okay
no.
with this.
I'm not
Why
okay.
Why does this feel like my parents making out?
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm put off by this. But here's something that I don't know how many people know this. This movie went through a rewrite because the initial screenwriter walked off the project after disagreeing with the director. And one of the people brought on to do a rewrite of the film was J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams did a rewrite of this movie, which is surprising because I don't remember there being any lens flares in the car chases. But
well, that's because this was back in the day when he was a script doctor. I mean, this is, keep in mind that this era right here, if you watch from like 95, 96 up through the early 2000s, you're going to find a lot of like really big names, like huge geek names doing rewrites on stupid shit. Mm-hmm. Like you talk about Speed and Twister, where almost all the dialogue in both of those movies was written by Joss Whedon.
Yeah.
When he was script doctoring and trying to clean up these scripts while they were shooting. And this is one of those cases. J.J. Abrams was one of those guns for hire who
not only worked on this, but let's not forget Gone Fishing.
Oh, well,
J.J. worked on.
Yeah, well, not worked on. Didn't he write Gone Fishing?
He was one of the writers on Gone Fishing.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, you know, and this remake also pulls off the magical unicorn feat of putting both Will Patton and Robert Duvall in the same movie when conventional wisdom tells you that you only get Will Patton if you cannot afford Robert Duvall.
You get both. And
you get both in this movie.
The cast in this movie is really,
yeah,
really kind of, in fact, that's one of the hallmarks of all the movies we're going to talk about tonight. All the movies we're going to talk about tonight are movies that got better with age simply because the actors they cast have become even greater than they were then. And it's just like, how did you make that movie? And it's like, because that person wasn't a big star at the time and you could do that.
Right.
And this is one of those movies.
Which makes it even more impressive how much Delroy Lindo stands out in all these movies.
Oh, yeah.
Despite, you know, there being an amazing cast around him. I mean, Nicolas Cage, Giovanni Ribisi, Angelina Jolie, Scott Conn, Will Patton, Delroy Lindo, Timothy Oliphant, Chi McBride, Robert Duvall, Christopher Eccleston, Vinnie Jones. I mean, like that's the cast of this movie.
Their villain is Doctor Who.
Their villain
They're
is
fighting
Doctor Who.
Doctor Who.
It never rains, but it pours.
And Delroy Lindo, his partner in this movie, is Timothy Oliphant in the worst performance he's ever given.
It's such a shittily written character.
It is. It's terrible.
It's like the quip machine young rookie cop who's not really a presence, and he says things like, yeah, man, by the time you get out of jail, like, it's like, motherfucker, we won't even be driving cars.
People will be flying
to work. Yeah. It's just like, shut up.
Oh, dude.
I love you as an actor, but please, for all of us, shut up.
But what's awesome is that Timothy Oliphant grew up to become the white Delroy Lindo. Like, he's the Delroy Lindo guy now. When you need a guy to come in to have that quiet, calm, but alpha as fuck kind of attitude,
yeah,
you get Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah.
And that's, you look at Delroy Lindo in this movie and you see so much of Rayland Givens,
mm-hmm,
from Justified. And it was kind of cool to kind of watch and see Timothy Oliphant kind of learn under Delroy Lindo.
Yeah. And I love that Delroy Lindo, who was playing the cop that's after Nicolas Cage and his team of car thieves, there is that sort of like, there's that respect there. He obviously respects Memphis Raines, but at the same time, he's consumed by wanting to catch him in the act. Like, because Memphis Raines has been retired for a long time, so he wants to be the guy that arrests him as he makes his big comeback. And yet, the whole time, there is this sort of, there's this, like, respect along with the animosity between the two of them, which I think is really fun to watch.
And there's a history.
And there's a history there.
And then you get, and of course, Delroy Lindo gets some of the best dialogue. You know, there's that great thing where he's telling him, he's like, look, if you jaywalk, if you park in the wrong space, if you use an aerosol can in a manner other than directed, it's just, it's that, oh, man, that relationship between them is great, and then of course comes to a head in the third act where it really, you know, you get to see who he is and who Memphis Raines really is, and it's awesome.
Yeah, and not only that, but the interesting thing about the two movies, the original and the remake, is that there's very little similarity between the two movies. Like, they are night and day different. But one of the very, very few scenes that exists in both movies is the scene in which Delroy Lindo shows up at the garage. The one kid has just boosted a car that wasn't on the list that had cocaine in the back seat, and now there's like cocaine on the floor as Delroy Lindo's cop character comes in. And so they kind of get him to rev up the engine to blow the cocaine away. And it's just, it's really fitting to me that one of the only scenes that made it from the original into the remake involves Delroy Lindo just kind of having fun and revving up an engine, which, by the way, Delroy Lindo also went through, stunt driver training with Nicolas Cage, at a place called, Bobby Orr's Stunt Driving School, which sounds totally legit and not like, the exact place that Nicolas Cage is running at the beginning of this movie. Yeah. But yeah, that's one of the only scenes apparently that made the cut from the original to the remake. And I highly recommend, by the way, seeing both of them, because the original does have a 40-minute long chase scene at the end, which is still,
Doesn't it crash 90 cars? That was the big thing. We destroy 90 cars in the final chase of this movie.
And it still hasn't been. It's still the longest car chase in film history. It's a solid 40 reason. Minutes,
yeah.
And it's outstanding to watch.
It's essentially the car chase version of Born to Fight.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, Lindo in this is so good because, again, he's the cop that doesn't have to be Timothy Olyphant. He's the cop that doesn't have to run off at the mouth the entire time. Like, you get the message with him as soon as he walks in the room.
Yeah.
He doesn't need to say too much, although he does choose his words very carefully and does have some really great dialogue in this, and it just makes it fun to watch. It, like, overall, like, with all the various elements here, the great stunts, the fun cast, and this weird sort of respect-laden animosity between Nicolas Cage and Delroy Lindo, I think, is what elevates this to... I mean, this could have been a really forgettable movie.
Yeah. Well, it's the thing is, what I found interesting rewatching this was this movie really got heavily slagged on when it came out. And it was directed by Dominic Cena, who was a guy who shot for Michael Bay. And he was seen as, everyone was looking at him as the Michael Bay you get when you can't get Michael Bay, which, of course, it was every bit the slam at the time that it would be now. And this movie got caught a lot of flack that I don't think it deserves. I think several of the Fast and Furious movies are better than this, but they're derivative of this.
True.
The look and, I mean, hell, the final scene of this movie has appeared in, what, 4 Fast and the Furious films so far?
Pretty much,
where,
yeah,
it's like, hey, let's get all the characters together for a barbecue at their house.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and they have that great moment with Vinnie Jones there. I thought you were from Long Beach.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I did have that thought watching the ending of this. I'm like, I've seen this ending before.
Several times. Yeah, it really does hold up as an enjoyable, fun watch. And that final car chase, despite being not the true, you know, carnage-gasm that you have in the original film, still is really well paced, really well done, and really entertaining.
Totally. And moving on from Gone in 60 Seconds, we are now going to talk about Heist.
Heist.
Now, this is AKA the Get Shorty reunion, because this film also stars Gene Hackman, Danny DeVito, and Delroy Lindo, who are all in Get Shorty, just a few years prior to this. Now, I should preface this by saying, this is not a sexy heist movie. And the reason I feel the need to say that is because this movie came out in 2001, the exact same year as Soderbergh's Ocean's 11.
Yes.
Which is a super sexy, like, it's all about Vegas, and look at these, like,
hyper stylized
movie stars,
funny,
as, you know, heistmen and all this stuff. And this is something different. This is David Mamet, and this feels like something more like The Outfit or Point Blank. I mean, very much like something Donald Westlake.
Yeah,
it's very gritty and it's very blue collar, and I mean, the robbery itself takes place at a podunk airport, not even a major, like, international airport, just like an airport on the outskirts of town that happens to have exactly what they need. Like, this is a no frills robbery movie, and because it is Mamet, it focuses on the characters, and that's why I think Delroy Lindo is able to shine even alongside Gene Hackman.
Well, everything you're talking about is exactly what Mamet was going for. I mean, when the movie opens up, it opens up with the old 1940s black and white logo that they used to use in the old noir films.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's like, this is what we're trying to evoke here. And they nail it. And it's really cool. And I think the problem with this film is that it is much smarter than most people at the time gave it credit for. And so it got slagged for being a misfire because people didn't like the ending. And the ending is actually very different than you necessarily think the ending is, which makes this a really fascinating film because it's one of those films that it takes... Sometimes it'll take people two or three watches to really catch on to what's going on. Because there are things that appear to make sense but not make sense in the film until you kind of get the primer. And once you've got that, you realize what this film really is. And it's really kind of fucking cool.
See, I find that surprising because one of the things I actually liked about Heist is that it didn't seem like it was trying to overcomplicate the story. In fact, I wouldn't call anything that happens in the movie even a twist. I mean, it would be a slight turn, perhaps, but I mean, there's nothing that feels, you know, like you want, again, I'll compare it to Ocean's 11, which came out the same year. Ocean's 11 is intentionally withholding things from the audience so that it can have this big sort of prestige magic trick reveal at the end. And this movie has nothing like that. Like, the turns that happen are all based on characters' motives. And I don't know. I didn't feel like it was that hard to follow.
I disagree, because the thing is that it does have a big twist, but the twist doesn't appear on camera. The twist in the ending. Okay, so let's do the setup of this, and then let's have a short spoiler section where we'll discuss that for anyone that wants to go back and revisit Heist. So basic premise: it's a group of criminals who pull off a heist at the beginning. They go in to get their money. Gene Hackman, this is his last gig. He's taking the money. He's going. He got burnt on the first gig. He fucks up, and he's got to go. And he's got a boat. He's going to take his money. He's going to sail somewhere with his wife. And then they go into the guy who hired them, Danny DeVito, and he won't give them the money.
Right.
He's not going to pay them for the gig because he's putting their money towards the next big heist, which they want no part of. And they kind of get fucked into a situation where they have to do this heist. And so they decide to do the heist, but they decide to do it their way. But they don't trust this guy. So they kind of start setting up all these elements to the heist to double cross and to prepare to be double crossed. And then we have what happens to, you know, the second act is this really cool slow burn heist. And then the third act is all the double crosses. And it is magnificently told. It's nice. It's quiet. It's character driven. It's really interesting. As we talked about, we've got Delroy Lindo, who's one of the chief guys on the job and clearly one of the only guys Gene Hackman trusts. We've got Ricky Jay.
Who, by the way, is considered one of the greatest sleight of hand magicians in the world.
He is.
Which I think is really funny.
The dude can throw playing cards into things and, you know, embed them in watermelons. It's kind of fucking crazy.
Yeah.
He's really talented. And this is an era where he showed up in a lot of stuff. And he was one of Mamet's favorites. And then, of course, what is the name of the actress?
Rebecca Pidgeon.
Yeah, Rebecca Pidgeon is the other member. And then, of course, we've got Danny DeVito and Danny DeVito's nephew, Sam Rockwell.
Yeah.
Who wasn't huge at the time, was just starting to come up. And
plays a character named Jimmy Silk.
Yes.
So
yes,
there's that.
And so this movie is all about watching these heists go down and everything that goes wrong and all the double crosses.
Yeah, and it culminates into this situation where, I mean, I don't know how spoilery we want to get here, but with all the double crosses, you know, you seem like people have made the necessary contingencies for who they think is going to screw them over, and then some of that is dealt with in a more violent fashion in what happens on the docks and who kind of gets removed from the equation on the docks, which is a really, really fun scene. I thought the way they handled the shootout on the docks was really, really entertaining.
Yeah.
And actually made Danny DeVito seem like kind of a heavy hitter,
yeah,
which you don't see very often in a movie.
No.
Even movies where he's played sort of criminal characters, he's always just sort of like, yeah, whatever, dude. But in this movie, I was like, wow, I kind of buy him as a heavy hitter. And I will say this, one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie is somebody pulls in Danny DeVito's office, somebody pulls a gun on Delroy Lindo. You should not pull a gun on Delroy Lindo.
No, you should not.
Because, and the thing is, like, he just takes it away from him and beats the guy. Like, there's no, like, there's no angry exchange or anything. It's just like, nope, that's not going to happen, and let me show you why in a few quick moves that end up with you on the ground crying and me still being Delroy Lindo, only now I've got your gun. And it was just like, well, yeah, that's pretty much why we love Delroy Lindo in one scene.
So let's talk about the ending for a moment.
Spoiler alert.
Yes, spoiler alert. Okay. So the ending, there's been this ongoing thing, this ongoing scenario between Gene Hackman's wife, Fran, played by Rebecca Pidgeon, and Sam Rockwell's character. Now, initially, Gene Hackman kind of sends her to Sam Rockwell to distract him, to kind of, you know, to kind of throw people off. And then it becomes the question of, is she really involved with Sam Rockwell? I mean, you kind of see them at one point in the movie seem like they're double-crossing Gene Hackman, but then that doesn't go the way that you think it's going to go, and you don't know how much she was involved with screwing over Sam Rockwell as he's trying to screw over Gene Hackman. And then it culminates into where the movie seems like it's about to end, and then all of a sudden Sam Rockwell shows up again with Rebecca Pidgeon, and the two of them drive off with quote-unquote the gold. It's like, nope, you shouldn't have, and she says, you shouldn't have sent me to him as a distraction. She's obviously pissed off, and the two of them drive away together with what they think is the gold. Turns out they don't have the gold, and the ultimate ending is that Gene Hackman still, despite everyone's you know, trying to double cross him, still comes out ahead. So I mean,
drives off with the gold.
I mean, I don't think I've missed anything here,
except that Rebecca Pidgeon is still in on it with Hackman. That's the big kind of off-screen clincher.
Wow, then that's really silly. If that's the case, that is really silly.
It seems that way, except one of the things that this film does, this film's got some really cool noirish dialogue. You know, there's this you know, great moment where, like, is he cool? My motherfucker's so cool, when he closes eyes, sheep count him. But they have these moments where the members of the crew speak to each other in code.
Right.
And they speak to each other in code that the audience doesn't even get. Like, he says, how long is this going to take? And he's like, as long as a Chinese name. And then Ricky Jay goes, how long is a Chinese name? You ever notice that? And the thing is he's not actually talking to Rockwell at that moment in that scene. He's actually speaking in code with Lindo. Okay. And at the end of the movie, when Rebecca Pidgeon has pulled the double cross, they look at each other and she just goes, it's a cute job, right? And he goes, cute as a Chinese baby. And she just nods and then goes and gets in the truck.
But see, my whole thing is, that's completely unnecessary. If that's the case, she brought, so what you're essentially saying is that she brings Rockwell to where Gene Hackman was going to drive off into the sunset just to trick Sam Rockwell into thinking he was driving off into the sunset. If she hadn't brought him there, they would have been over anyway. So I don't see, like, that's like...
He was coming after them anyway, and
he... But he's still going to when he finds out it's not gold. But he's, I don't understand that.
It's very worth a rewatch from this angle.
I'm just saying.
You may not like it as much. No, I like it. I like it.
No,
even more
I'm saying
this
I don't agree with that. That's what's going on. And if it is what's going on, I think it's a weakness of the movie. So I can't get behind that, dude. I'm sorry. Like,
I like that because it's very much like The Spanish Prisoner. You know, it's very much one of these Mamet films where Mamet is playing around with the audience and keeping the audience out of the situation to understand the situation.
Yeah, no, and I get that about Mamet, but I'm just saying, like, if that's what's going on, I just personally I don't think it works in this movie.
I like that ending a lot. But then again, it's an ending up for interpretation.
Yeah.
There is the possibility that Mamet thought he was being clever but was suffering from an aneurysm at the moment and was just making these jokes that didn't make any fucking sense. But it
could
really
be that, I guess.
It really
yeah.
does seem like they're speaking in code. And maybe in speaking in code, she has betrayed him, but he's telling her something else that we don't quite know, almost in the very same way that at the end of Lost in Translation, when Bill Murray leans in and whispers in her ear, we're not supposed to know what's being said.
Right.
We're supposed to get the sense of it. And that's them talking in code one last time. That's another interpretation of the movie, and neither is wrong because there isn't evidence either way. But I got the impression that they were still in on this together.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel the movie ends.
And it's just such a great old school style, you know, noir-y heist movie that I feel we, after that movie comes out, after Ocean's 11 and after the films that would follow, I just feel like the standard for the heist movie changes dramatically.
Yeah.
To where they all are about, you know, super being super sexy and these like
well, it's all about being criminal superheroes.
Being criminal superheroes and being like the sexiest criminal ever. Like Gene Hackman is not a sex symbol in 2001.
It's the team, you know, the only sexy person is Rebecca Pidgeon. The rest of it is Ricky Jay, Delroy Lindo, and Gene Hackman, of which you could say Delroy Lindo was the sex symbol.
Yes, you could. Also, I want Delroy Lindo with a shotgun in my corner for everything.
Dude, the thing is he's so badass in this, but they play down like that. Normally in a movie like this, that character would be a tough talking jackass the whole time that you'd end up loving because he comes through. And instead he's this very soft spoken, very down to earth guy who cares for his friends, but doesn't have any relationship with his friends outside of their work.
Yeah.
Like there's that scene at the end of the movie
when he's in the car with his wife.
Yeah. With his wife. Who is that? It's like, oh, some old guy was asking me for a tip on a fight.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, his wife doesn't even know who his best friend is.
And conversely, Gene Hackman has no idea this guy's even married.
Yeah. So, it's really there's just so many great layers to this movie that regardless of what you think of the ending, regardless of which ending you want, it's a movie to watch for the characters and for the dynamics and for this great slow burn tension.
Definitely. Hey, speaking of layers. Let's talk about this movie that you love that I can't even.
It's time.
I
have talked for so long about doing this. You're like, we're not going to do it. You're like, we're going to do it. You're like, we're not going to do it. I'm like, Delroy Lindo episode. We're going to do it. We're going to talk about the core.
I think I have a pretty fairly high threshold for schlock. I mean, we did do an episode about the entirety of the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise.
We did, and you've seen it all.
I've seen them all. I could barely sit through the core. It took everything within me to make it to the end of this 2003 sci-fi actioner about, oh no, the Earth's core stopped spinning, we better drop some nukes into it, and go.
Yeah, it's how do we remake Armageddon? Well, what about instead of hitting an asteroid, because actually there were two movies that came out that year, Deep Impact and Armageddon. What can we do? Well, why don't we send them into the Earth's core? And the movie just gets even more ludicrous from there. I do not love this movie because it's good.
I was going to say, yes, you do, but okay.
No, I love the moments in this movie. I love the characters in this movie. And I love how gleefully unrepentant this movie is about being what it is. For a while, I was operating under the assumption that this was actually some kind of Andy Kaufman level stunt where somebody was like, I've got an idea. I'm going to go into this meeting and they're going to say, what do you got? And I'm just going to go, how about Armageddon in the Earth's core? And everybody's going to laugh. And then I won't have to answer today. And somebody said, wait, no, that's brilliant.
Oh, no,
and
it's very real.
And so it's like, well, let's see how far we can go with this. Because it's so goddamn ludicrous.
No argument there.
Right down to we need to build a ship that can withstand the pressure of going into the Earth. And
what are we
going to
build it out of?
Unobtainium. Which is unobtainium is a real scientific word, and it's a real scientific word that means something, you know, any kind of thing with a property that we can't normally manufacture yet or come to. It's just a nebulous X factor to plug into scientific things to figure out what that X factor is.
That's like saying they built the ship out of imaginary numbers.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. It's like, well, we took tungsten and we put it together and unobtainium. And I love how Delroy Lindo delivers the line where it's like, look, it's 37 syllables long, but I call it unobtainium. And it's like, ba-da-ba-ba-da-ba-ba.
It's like Prince trying to tell you his name.
But so here's what I love about the core. The core is it is that Armageddon movie with an unbelievable Oscar-nominated, Oscar-caliber cast, like of some of the best actors working in Hollywood in history, all together in one movie, and none of them is phoning it in. not one of them phones in their performance. You know, the most boring character in this movie to watch it again, you know, through history was actually one of the, you know, funnier, you know, comic relief characters early, you know, when it first came out, DJ Qualls.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And
who actually says hack the planet twice in the course of the movie.
Yes. Cause that's what this movie is. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, he's got
it wants you to think fondly and compare it fondly to hackers. That's what this, because the effects in this movie are about as bad as they were in the movie Hackers.
Oh, some of them are pretty bad.
They're so... dude, this came out after Armageddon, okay? Yes. Armageddon's effects look like the pinnacle. We'll never be able to top that in our lives compared to this. And this came out after... this came out after movies like Jurassic Park. Like, I don't understand. I don't understand why the effects... why it looks like... that they are drilling through stratum upon stratum of screensavers. Like, that's how they choose to represent the core of the Earth. Is just like these, oh, these kind of like MTV music video waving lines. And the weird thing is,
tell me the weird thing.
They actually
tell me the
had,
one weird thing about the core.
No, about its effects. They had 5 extra months to finish the effects. This was supposed to come out in 2002, and they said, no, you know what? We're going to commit 5 more months to post-production so we can really tighten up these effects. So what you're seeing in this movie is the second pass at the effects, and it still looks like it was done by the Weekend crew at the Sci-Fi Channel.
And yet you do not watch the core for its effects.
Okay. What do you watch it for?
Dude, I love the characters in this movie. I really do. Okay, so let's run down this cast that we're talking about. I know you've got the list in front of you.
I do. We have Aaron Eckhart as Dr. McHandsome. We have...
go ahead and give them their names, because you know what? The real names don't matter. You're right. He is Dr. McHandsome, but he's Dr. Scruffy McHandsome.
Dr. Scruffy McHandsome. Hilary Swank as Take Me Seriously, I'm an Astronaut.
Yes.
Delroy Lindo as Dr. Unabomber.
Yes.
We have Stanley Tucci as Dr. Up His Own Ass.
Yes.
We've already mentioned DJ Qualls as Hack the Planet. And then I believe the other character is the French
scientist.
Isn't
it Jürgen Prochnow that's in this?
Is it Jürgen Prochnow? Oh, and of course, Bruce Greenwood as Commander Get Out of My Way.
Commander Get Out of My Way. And you've also forgotten Alfre Woodard as, you know, her name in the movie, Stick. So let's just leave it as Stick.
Yeah, she's, Stick.
And then Richard Jenkins.
Yes.
As
Condescending General.
As Condescending General. And who's going to destroy the world. And so you have this cast in what is a 50s B movie. And what if the screenwriter of this film, one of the screenwriters is to be believed, is exactly what studio execs were trying to make. There's, you know, one of the famous stories that happened at AIC, and one of my favorite moments was there was an early test screening review of this that was just lambasting it for its terrible science. And one of the screenwriters wrote into Harry and wrote an open letter that was published on the site about how the science in this is 100% accurate and they have spent lots of time getting it accurate, and gets to a point where they go, wouldn't understand what we're going through. We have a producer on the film that was trying to put a scene with dinosaurs in it. They wanted dinosaurs in the center of the Earth. And when I heard that, I was like, yes, that's what this movie needed. This movie is one moment of Bruce Greenwood getting his shirt torn off by a monster away from this being a Doug McClure movie. And that's what this is. But what you have is this great cast of actors who are just doing their damnedest to try to make this passable, and they work. And they each get these great character moments. Delroy Lindo is great as the scientist here.
He is as much as I don't like this movie, he's the best part of this movie, hands down. Like,
I don't know, because Stanley Tucci is hilarious. Stanley Tucci's final moments is in my top 10 favorite death scenes.
Yeah, his redemption
ever.
Is great, but you have to slog through, like, the most... I'm sorry, I just thought it was, like, really broadly drawn. I'm the snooty, self-absorbed scientist who wants all the glory for himself. It's
but
like,
he was so good at being the snooty, narcissistic scientist.
It was fine.
Like, the moment where he goes to sign Aaron Eckhart's report that he's trying to hand him to show him that the Earth is going to blow up is hilarious. This movie's filled with these character moments that are clearly generated by actors. And, like, even Alfre Woodard's moment where she has to, you know, damn you, Richard Jenkins, you blew it up. You blew the whole thing up. She even makes that scene totally work, despite how broadly drawn that scene really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. Some of the dialogue in this is terrible, but watching these actors make it work and make it fun, I have, every time I've watched this movie, from the very first time when I walked in thinking it might actually be a good movie, I was howling with laughter. I was having fun. I was enjoying, and I love it when you have a movie that clearly isn't good, but the actors refuse to accept that fact and refuse to phone it in and give it their all despite the lines coming out of their mouth. You can tell in some movies, like it's the one that I always go to is like when you watch The Seeker, The Dark is Rising. Ian McShane, every time he spits out some line of magical gobbledygook, you can see him like sneering at the end like he's waiting for them to yell cut so he can start swearing about what the fuck am I talking about? Give me a scotch, you cocksuckers.
Yeah.
Where here, they're in it. They're in their characters and the dynamics. And it gets what an adventure movie is. There's that moment when Delroy Lindo has gone and he's going to sacrifice himself
because it's for the mission. If it's supposed to be like a 50s movie, there's no way the black guy's going to survive.
Yeah, of course. But he volunteers. He's not killed off for the sake of being black.
That's true.
But there's that moment where he and Tucci make up, where they're these old rivals. They used to be friends. They split up and spent 20 years apart. One is now a fringe scientist and one is the biggest scientist in the world, and the moment where they make up is just such a great character moment done by two amazing actors who are taking two lines of dialogue and making a real emotional moment out of it. And this movie is filled with those.
Yeah.
And I love every bad bit about this movie until the last 5 minutes. Like, the last 5 minutes are where even I'm like,
wait,
all
whoa,
right.
You don't love DJ Qualls running across the top of a battleship going, it's the whales! The whales!
No, I don't.
Like some,
I don't like, and I don't like
some kid with the touch of the downs at SeaWorld just going crazy.
My version of that movie has them all die in the core. That's the point. That they all sacrifice themselves. The idea that the two that have a romantic link together make it back to the surface, to me, robs the movie of how good it is. That it is it reminds me very much of like that scene in Deep Impact where, because that does this so much better, where, you know, you've got the failed shuttle mission and then they realize that they could possibly save it, but they would all die doing it. And they just all kind of stare at each other, realizing what they're volunteering for. And then one of them just says, well, on the bright side, we'll all have middle schools named after us. And there's this moment of, you know, emotional release of that, of just like, oh, okay, fuck it. Let's save the human race. And that's what this movie needed. This movie needed that moment of sacrifice. It wouldn't have made this movie good, but I love it. And I know I'm not alone. There's a lot of people out there that just love it. But the thing is it feels like the movie that ended that run of disaster movies that was the nail in the coffin of the overblown Hollywood, Bruckheimer copy and paste, disaster movie. And as a last gasp, it's wonderful. It is so much fun. It is exactly the kind of junk food that I like. And the things that are good about this, I really do enjoy. And it's all those character moments. Every scene with Delroy Lindo is great. Most of it, you have issues with Aaron Eckhart in this.
He's so fucking whiny. I think he's really whiny. I think Hilary Swank is almost insufferable in this movie. And I, like, Delroy Lindo was literally like this one bright shining spot in the whole. It's like, oh, thank God for Delroy Lindo. Thank God for him in this movie, or I would have nothing to like about it. Like, again, I don't want to harp on the effects too much, but there's literally a point at the beginning where birds are flying into windows, and if you look carefully, you can see a trout being thrown against a window. Which was because the people who are doing the CG birds are like, wouldn't it be funny if we just threw a fish? But they don't care. They don't give two shits about what they're doing.
It's a movie about going to the center of the earth to set off nuclear and weapons to restart the core.
Which, by the way, I'm going to throw salt on this. No, it's a real thing that science would do. The screenwriter's argument, no. Because the one scientific consultant they had on this movie was a guy from Caltech. And after talking to the producers, he did publish an article in a scientific journal about how it was possible with an unmanned probe. He didn't, like, they actually did have a Caltech scientist, and he did say it was possible if there were no humans in that thing whatsoever. So I'm still going to call bullshit on the science of this, but I don't care about the science.
I'm not going to defend the science. I said he wrote that article. I think it's full of shit.
I think it's cuckoo bananas.
Sounds right. I mean, anytime you
unobtainium,
you know, then you have that whole thing of like, okay, so they drilled in and they're drilling down, so we're just going to shoot molten metal straight up to the mantle. That sounds like a great idea to me.
There's the upper crust, the mid crust, the flying toasters, and then the outer core and the inner core.
And then there's the hollow earth.
The hollow earth. Oh, good. Well, I'm so glad that you got to talk about the core.
We got to talk about, you know what? I enjoy the core. If you've never seen the core, it is, get a six pack of beer, sit down and enjoy it as the disaster movie it is. But enjoy those great character moments, because those character moments are what keeps bringing me back to that movie. Before we go on, I said Jürgen Prochnow earlier. No, it's Cheki Kariö. I think that's how it's pronounced.
I think it's just wishful thinking on your part that it kind of looks like a submarine.
It's still really, really good.
Speaking of people who look like each other, let's talk about the movie that stars Jet Li, and it's called The One from 2001. This was one of my, when I was younger, one of my deep fried favorites. I like, even, you know, watching this movie as a 17 year old kid, I was like, this sucks. Like, I recognize that this movie sucks.
Oh yeah,
but it's a lot of fun, and it hit like in its soundtrack. Its soundtrack is all like puddle of mud and
angry at your dad drowning music. Pool.
Yeah, it was all very like, yeah, fucking Disturbed. Yeah, like all kinds of just like.
It sounded like the indie rock station minus 311 of that era.
It was just metal palooza. And I think at that time, like, I really liked those songs, and I still like martial arts movies, and I really liked Jet Li. So it was just like everything. Plus, I had just discovered Snatch, and was like, oh my god, it's the guy from Snatch, and who's barely.
I love how we've now finally gotten to the part of your youth where you discovered Snatch.
I know, right? Yeah, this is 2000. Anyway, I discovered Snatch. Anyway, so this movie it takes place in the very near future.
No, and it also, doesn't.
Well, it does. The part where they actually have the multiverse agency area is the distant future, but this is supposed to be a few years. That's why they talk about, if you notice, even when we get to Jet Li, like our main Jet Li character's universe, they're talking about universal healthcare. I mean, how the president just passed universal healthcare. It's because this is supposed to take place a few years in the future, because when this movie was made in 2001... there was no such thing as universal healthcare, and it actually becomes sort of a weird, prescient thing, where it's like just this little clue that it wasn't in the distant future, but it was a little bit ahead of where, you know, the movie was made.
What I felt that scene is that what we're talking about is, of course, you know, this is an alternate reality movie, and
The basic premise is that there are multiple universes, and there's a version of you in every single universe who is a different person and married to different people, doing different jobs, look completely different nationalities. It's basically a Highlander ripoff. That's all this movie is.
It's a huge Highlander ripoff with a cool sci-fi premise that they make absolutely fucking ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
They had a chance to make this cool, and instead they're like, no, let's go for the comedy.
Yeah.
Because that's what will work. But so what we're talking about is how they delineate between a few of the universes is we walk by a television in a couple of scenes, and on one television, it's President Gore,
talking about his plan for universal healthcare.
And then in another universe, it's George Bush
also,
has just gotten approval for universal healthcare.
Yes.
So I've always felt that what that was that's clearly not our reality, because that's not, we don't get the George Bush that wants universal healthcare.
Well, no.
That was kind of the tip that, okay, this isn't our reality. This is still slightly different than our reality.
No, I'm not, I mean, this is not me reading into it. This is what the filmmakers have said, is that the movie, the prime universe that we are focused in takes place a couple of years into the future. So they were being very fucking optimistic and saying that George W. Bush was going to pass universal healthcare, which I'm with you. Still, something is rotten in Denmark. But anyway, so it's
much like the Jet Li variant from Denmark.
Yes.
Sven Law with the blonde hair.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. This movie starts off really, really cool. And then it just takes a left turn into retardedsville.
Yeah.
Like it just like not just dumbsville. Like it just gets.
No, full on our town.
It's really, it gets real, like, the old, because the idea, most of you out there listening to this, if you're a podcast listener, you probably have a basic fundamental understanding of multiple universes. You've probably watched enough films. You've probably watched Lost. You've probably seen various movies that deal with alternate universes. And this movie in alternate universes, there are just people that look like you that have completely different lives and nationalities, but the same race.
Yeah.
And they all have different names. And despite being a limited, a limitless amount of multiverses out there.
There are 125 of you, and that's it.
That's it. There's only
100. Settled on that number. I don't understand.
And it's well, here's and the movie gets even dumber, because when we realize this, when they give us this, we find out that Jet Li is Law. What is his? Which Law is he? He's.
Oh wait, you're talking about the good one or the
U-Law.
Bad
Law?
U-Law. Bad Law. Yeah, yeah.
U-Law is wanted for 123 counts of murder, but he's actually murdered many more than that. And we don't give a shit about that. We only care about the alternate hims he's murdered.
Right.
Not actually any of, like, the police officers we saw him murder in the previous scene.
Yeah, no, that is really weird. But, and again, I don't understand where this arbitrary, there are 125 versions of you. So the Highlander ripoff here is that every time he kills an alternate universe version of himself, he gains a little bit more power.
The quickening.
It's the quickening. And it's like every time he narrows it down, it spreads out. Like every time he kills someone, the other versions of those people, like the power is diffused between the remaining survivors. So it gets down to just him and Gabe Law, who is the good guy, the good Jet Li. And frankly, you can take and burn a lot of this movie. All I really care about is the sort of hyper stylized fight sequences that use this weird slow motion, because part of him gaining more speed is that he can, like, you know, kick people up in the air, and then while they're still falling, like, kick them in the side, and it's very kinetic, and it's very
he's
violent.
He's moving super fast, but we're having to watch everyone else in slow motion while he's walking normal. And it looks awesome.
Yeah.
Although they don't exactly explain it at first.
No.
So the first time you watch it, people are very thrown. Like, my wife just laughed out loud. She goes, yeah, because that could happen. I'm like, no, honey, he's got superpowers. And she's like, oh.
He's got superpower. Don't worry. This is dumber than you think.
Yeah. Well, no, because it's not dumber, because she'll buy superpowers, because audiences will buy, okay, oh, he's got superpowers. We're seeing superpowers. That's cool.
Uh-huh.
When you think this is actually reality,
right,
and that's what a real kung fu master is doing, you're kind of like, okay, that's fucking bullshit. But it doesn't tell you what it is at first. So the first time you watch it, you're like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. And so the two multiverse agents, that's what they're called, who are chasing the evil version of Jet Li are played by Jason Statham as the young brash rookie
with hair
and the I'm too old for this shit Danny Glover veteran played by Delroy Lindo, who, by the way, and this is another spoiler alert, Delroy Lindo's death in this movie made me so sad. Even when I first watched it, I was like, man, I really liked that guy. I wish he hadn't died. And then immediately after Jet Li kills him, he picks up a motorcycle or two motorcycles and, like, smashes a cop between them. And I was just like, I don't even remember that other guy died.
I'm so happy right now.
It was just like, wow, that was really cool. And then, but I will say this, because it's a situation where you're traveling between multiple universes, there's this really great scene that I think doesn't get enough credit, where Jason Statham, realizing he's now on his own to try and stop this evil version of Jet Li, comes across this universe's version of Delroy Lindo. Not the multiverse agent, but he's just working at a gas station. He comes across him, and it's just a really sweet moment where he goes up to the guy who has no idea who he is in this universe, and he thanks him. And he's just like, what the hell are you talking about? But it's just like this really heartfelt, sweet moment.
Yeah. And he's like, I'm going to call the cops.
Yeah. And it's just like, man, we get two Delroy Lindos for the price of one.
Yeah.
Hooray.
But way too many Jet Lis.
Way too many Jet Lis.
Keep in mind, this was the movie that Jet Li did after he turned down Matrix Reloaded.
Holy cow.
He was supposed to be in Matrix Reloaded, and he turned that down for the one.
I saw Matrix Reloaded. I think it's a push.
It really became six of one half dozen of the other.
Yeah.
But
did you know this about the one? It was originally set to star The Rock.
No.
This was going to be The Rock's big first vehicle, and he left this to go do Mummy Returns, where he has no lines. It's really interesting to me that he turned down a role where not only would he be the star, but there would be multiple hims in the movie.
Now, here's the thing that I will say, from, you know, experience in Hollywood and people knowing people who have worked with Dwayne Johnson and who know him personally, he's apparently smart as fuck when it comes to this stuff and has a really good sense and probably saw that the one was going the direction that it was going and then got offered a role in one of the biggest films of that time.
And decided to put ego aside and take a non-speaking role in a bigger movie.
Yeah.
That's smart. Yeah.
And, right, and even enough. Though that movie has a shit ending, you know, that was the movie that helped really launch his career.
True story. Another interesting piece of trivia, I don't know if you noticed this watching it, but that hospital that they're in, did it look familiar to you?
It did, but I couldn't place it.
It's the hospital where they filmed Scrubs.
Okay, so that
So the whole time, I love Scrubs. I'm a huge fan of that show, and like every time that they like walk outside, and I was like, okay, yeah, no, I totally recognize this entire hospital.
It would have been cool if they went to that universe.
Right?
and had a shootout in that universe. That would have been kind of amazing.
Jet Li singing, I can't do this all on my own.
And this...
I'm no Superman.
Yeah. This movie, though, it goes so off the rails. The thing about... I do not love this movie. I know you do, but you know what? I love the core, so I can't fucking talk right now. So I'll keep my mouth shut about that. But what I do dig about this movie is I put this movie in with Time Cop. Like, this is a movie to watch back to back with Time Cop.
Absolutely.
It is so stupid, but it's kind of enjoyable at times at how stupid it is. And some of the fight scenes are really cool. Some of the effects are really cool. I mean, there's some big problems. I mean, like, my biggest problem is we have this really great, interesting shootout at the beginning of the movie. So we just fucking repeat it.
Yeah, we'd see the same one again.
Fucking shootout. And it's like, wait, why couldn't that have been another great ambush action scene like that? Why did we have to? And it's like, you clearly had a budget on this. Mm-hmm. Why was this where you skimped? and then you get to the third act, which gets kind of weak, but then delivers one of the greatest terrible final lines of a movie ever.
This is true.
You law is no one's bitch. You are mine. And it's standing on this like shit ass pyramid in the Stygian universe. Yeah, and
But I will say the fight between Jet Li and Jet Li at the end of this, for being 2001, is pretty remarkably well done.
Yes. Yeah. No. And that was, and really, that was the whole selling point on this movie. Was the reason we all went into this movie on fucking opening night was because it's like Jet Li versus Jet Li in who gives a fuck what it's called. It's got Jet Li fighting Jet Li. The only man that can beat Jet Li is Jet Li. and we were stoked, and then we didn't get enough Jet Li versus Jet Li. And but at the same time, going back and rewatching this with the lens of time, it's fucking Delroy Lindo driving around with Delroy Lindo has traded in Timothy Oliphant
for Jason Statham.
Like, here's the thing: if you ever want to be an amazing, you know, actor, just an actor, alpha actor, build a time machine, go back in time and get a job in a movie playing Delroy Lindo's sidekick. And then when you grow up, you too can grow up to be a super badass.
True story.
Now, the problem with Statham in this is Statham isn't any good in this.
Not really. No.
But it's clearly not Statham's fault because he had just done Snatch where he's amazing. And it's clear that this was director issues and he hadn't quite secured his gruff mumble. I'm going to play the same character over and over again for $5 million a movie. I don't care what the movie is, that we do enjoy today.
Well, that's going to bring us to our junk food pairing. And for this one, I went with sesame cake. Now, we didn't talk about the movie Congo today.
No, we did not.
Mostly for lack of time and because it's Congo.
And because it's Congo. And we only wanted to talk about movies that at least one of us enjoyed.
Yes, there you go. But that oh-so-silly Killer Ape movie, based on the book by Michael Crichton, features a staggeringly impressive cast. Like, suspiciously impressive. Like, what are some of these people doing in this stinker impressive? And one of those standouts is, of course, Delroy Lindo as African warlord Captain Wanta, who, in one of the most hilarious pairings of hostility and baked goods, intimidatingly commands Tim Curry's character to
stop eating my sesame cake!
And Tim Curry just spits out this huge... It's the most bizarre non sequitur in a... And again, in a movie about giant killer apes, it still feels out of left field. And you know what? No matter what character Lindo plays, no matter what the situation or how much you think you have him pegged, at his calm but firm command, you too would spit out a giant mouthful of sesame cake.
Sesame cake.
Sesame cake. Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Junk Food Cinema. I hope you guys have enjoyed coming with us on our journey through our favorite black character actors. And, of course, we will have to do more of them because
There's too many.
But I want to remind you yet again, we are on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema or like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargo, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at facebook.com/massaworm.
You can find me at Bri Guy Salisbury on Twitter. On Facebook, you can find my page, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. And also check out oneofus.net, my home away from home, for blogs and podcasts and what have you. But that's going to do it for the show. So for Cargo, this is Brian reminding you to always keep your kung fu strong.